Thanks for listening to one of our messages at Crossroads Bible Church. We gather on Sunday mornings at 10 a.m. in person and online. To find out more about our church or to connect to any of our ministries, visit our website at crossroadsbible.org. We hope you enjoy the message and pray it encourages you as you seek to follow Jesus.
Well, hi guys, good morning. Thank you so much for worshiping with us today. My name is Delyn Miracle, and it is a joy and a privilege to get to be with you this morning. Charlie is away again at a wedding. He had two out-of-town weddings back-to-back weekends, but he'll be back with us next week. And we're going to begin our service just the way that we always do. We want to take a moment just to stop down and to recognize what we walked in here with. Our culture trains us to think critically, to be critical, to make decisions of what we like and what we don't like. And we're all here this morning to experience God, to hear from Him, and to be present with Him. And the one thing that really will prevent us from hearing from God this morning is a spirit of critique. And so we want to let go of that this morning. We always say that the move of the Spirit is inward to conviction and not outward to critique. So let's take just a moment to pray that the Lord would be near to us this morning, that He would give us ears to hear Him and eyes to see Him, that we would release to Him all of the things that we need to let go of at this moment just so that we can be near Him. I'm going to invite you to take a moment just to pray silently to yourself, and then we'll begin. Jesus, thank you for this time. Thank you for your nearness. Thank you that you want to be with us. Thank you that you want to help us. We ask that you do that today. It's in your name we pray. Amen. Well, Sherry mentioned just a little bit ago that there was a conference last week, and I was one of the 10 or 15 Crossroads people who were there. The conference is put on every September by the Apprentice Institute up in Wichita, Kansas at Friends University. The founder of the Institute is James Bryan Smith. And when he got up on this stage, he introduced himself the way he always does. He got up and he said, "My name is James Bryan Smith, but I know that you know me if you call me Jim." You see, Jim Smith is a pretty generic name. Don't you agree? And so he says that he has to use all the names his mama gave him for his publishing name. And a little more than a decade ago, I read a couple of his books, and they were just really great. They were really foundational in my thinking about God and His kingdom. I really loved them. And back in 2018, I asked him to come here to Crossroads to do a women's retreat for me, and the whole staff laughed at me. They all laughed and said, "There is no way that he is coming here to Crossroads Bible Church to do a women's retreat for you. He does not do small events, Delyn." And to our great surprise, he said, yes, he came. And when he was here, as soon as he got here in the building, like the first thing he said to me was, "Call me Jim." And I was like, "Oh, that's kind of awkward. You're James Bryan Smith. I'm going to have a hard time calling you Jim." And so one of the nights that he was here with us, we invited him out to our home along with all of the church staff for them to hang out with him and kind of get to know him a little bit. And something really special happened at that dinner. Let me take just a minute to pause to kind of give you a little bit of the backstory. When I was in college, I loved Rich Mullins. I loved Rich Mullins. And my kid grew up listening to a lot of Rich Mullins music in the car. So much so that when she became interested in music, she asked us for a hammered dulcimer. Do you know what that is? The musical instrument? It's an instrument that Rich was famous for playing. And so we went up to Oklahoma to the factory where Rich had his dulcimers made. We saw the whole process of how they're made, and we left with a beautiful dulcimer that Tatum picked out. So that night at dinner, Tatum asked Jim if she could play her dulcimer for him. And of course, she played Rich's music. You see, Rich lived with Jim and his wife Megan for several years. They were super close friends. And so now Jim had a connection to Tatum and I because he knew that we dearly loved his close friend. So when Tatum was, it was time for her to start looking for colleges to attend, I required that she at least consider going up to Friends University, where Jim teaches. And I told Jim that we were coming up for a visit, and y'all, he cleared his schedule for an entire day. He drove us around, all around Wichita. He took us to all of Rich's favorite places. We had lunch at his favorite restaurant, a place that he and Brennan Manning and Rich used to love to go to for lunch. We went to his favorite bookstore. We drove by the house that they lived in together. He took us to different places in Wichita that had inspired lines in songs that we knew and loved, and we were like, oh my gosh, that's what he's talking about. We ended our day having dinner with Jim and his family at his home. Guys, he rolled out the red carpet trying to get Tatum to come to Friends. And she didn't. But I did, actually. Just shortly thereafter, I decided I'm pushing her to try to go do something that I really want to do. And so I applied, and I started a program with the Apprentice Institute, and it was short-lived because COVID killed it, and I didn't get to finish, unfortunately. So it had been a couple of years since I had seen Jim when I saw him last week at the conference. And when I saw him, he had his usual greeting for me. He ran up, and he threw his arms up and said, "It's a miracle!" And then he whipped his phone out and said, "Let's take a picture and let's send it to Tatum." I was kind of thinking, Jim, my hair is kind of falling, but I didn't say any of that. I just said, thanks. He's such a gracious, gracious man. And the last day of the conference, last Saturday, I was getting in my seat and waiting for everything to get started. And I realized that I was sitting right behind his wife and his in-laws, and his sister, and his cousin. And I sat there and I thought, well, I know Jim. Like, you know what would be really, really awkward for me now? It'd be for me to call him James, right? He's Jim to me. And while I know Jim, I don't know him like they know him. He's family to them. Today, what we're going to be talking about is that we're going to be talking about how we know God, how we know that we know God. Do we know him like an author, like James Bryan Smith? Or do we know him by a man named Jim, who I've spent a couple of really great days with? Or do we know him like he's our family? You know, it seems to me that our society is wanting to know God. At least our pocketbooks say that we do want to know. So some research from Words Rated and Barna and the American Bible Society say things like, over the last decade, religious book sales have increased by 32.5%. Last year, we bought almost 180 million religious books. We spent somewhere around the idea of $757.7 million on religious books last year, just in 2022. And as of 2015, somewhere between 5 and 7 billion Bibles have been sold. Like, that's approaching almost one for every person on the planet. That's a lot of Bibles. And here in the U.S., almost 9 out of 10 households, 87% of households in the U.S. own a Bible. And the average household owns 3. It seems to me that we're interested in knowing God. But if someone asks you how well you know God, what would your answer be? Would your answer be something like, I've read his books and I think he's pretty good? Or would your answer be, he's my dad? He's my family. I belong to him. Today, we're going to look at how John says we can know God. We're in the middle of a sermon series in 1 John, and today we're in chapter 2, verses 3 through 6. Let's read them together. It says, we know that we have come to know him if we keep his commands. Whoever says, I know him, but does not do what he commands, is a liar, and the truth is not in that person. But if anyone obeys his word, love for God is truly made complete in them. This is how we know we are in him. Whoever claims to live in him must live as Jesus did. So what does John mean when he says to know God? Well, we're going to use 5 questions to frame our discussion about that. Okay, so let's jump straight into our first question. Our first question is, does John mean that this is how you know if you're really saved? If like you're in or you're out? Let's think about that. It's not hard at all to find teachers and commentators who will say, yes, that is what John is saying. But I don't agree with that. You see, if we think back to just what Britt told us last week about the verses that are just prior to these, we learned that John is speaking to people he calls dear children, people that he considers to be his family. He's writing to people that are believers. They're definitely on the inside of the crowd here, right? And so that leads us then to our second question. Okay, so if these people are actually believers, are they questioning their faith? Are they wondering if they're really saved? When I was young, I realize now that as that just rolled off my tongue, that I'm implying that I'm not young, that I might be old. Well, anyway, back when I was young, I used to actually kind of not like the letter of 1 John. I kind of thought it was harsh a little bit. Like, the language was harsh. I thought these contrasts that John uses, light and dark, he talks about people who know the truth and people who are liars and that are even deceiving themselves. And it made me scared. It made me wonder, does my life look enough like Jesus? Am I deceiving myself? Am I really saved? And you know, I want us to think about, is that what John is saying? Is he writing to try to get you to look inside yourself and ask the question if you're really saved? Let me say the answer to that just as plain and simple as I know how. No. No, he is not. That is not what he is saying at all. We have to remember who he's writing to. He's writing to a network of house churches that are in and around Ephesus. And what is happening to these churches is some false teachers have come in, and man, they are ripping these churches to shreds. They are in the middle of a crisis. And so John's harsh words aren't aimed at the believers. His harsh words are aimed at the false teachers and their crazy teachings. Like, he wants to use all these contrasts, like light and dark and fellowship and those who have nothing to do with God. He's using those contrasts because he wants the believers to understand just how wrong, how crazy wrong these false teachers' beliefs are about God. So last week, Britt talked to us about the heresy of docetism. But, you know, I really think that they might also be experiencing some of the early infiltration of Gnosticism into the early church. Especially the way John is talking about how we know God. Because you know what the Gnostics thought? They thought that they had the secret knowledge about who God really is. They believed that they had the secret intel on who God is. They believed some really crazy things that at least sound crazy to you and I. I will tell you that Britt heard it last week on TikTok, the ideas of Gnosticism, and we're like, oh my gosh, where is this coming from? All over again. What they believed is that everything physical is bad. So like our bodies are bad. The world is bad. And the only good part of us is our non-material, like our mind, our brain, our spirit. Like those were actually the only thing that matters. And some of the Gnostics even believed that since our bodies are bad, that whatever we do in the body is totally irrelevant. If you want to lie, steal, rape, cheat, no problem. Those things are done in the physical body, and they don't count for anything. So I want us to take for just a second and think about what that kind of looks like and means for knowing God. If they thought the physical body was bad, what do you think they thought about the creator of our physical bodies, the creator of this world? They thought he was the actual real essence of evil. And it's probably no surprise to you then to know that in their narrative, in the creation account, guess who they said the good guy is? The good guy is the serpent. He's the one who's trying to rescue Adam and Eve from the evil creator. Isn't that sound just like a lie that Satan would make up? I mean, it seems kind of crazy, doesn't it? So if it seems so crazy, why do you think that these early Christians were confused by it? Why do you think they didn't go, well, that's obviously a lie? Well, you have to remember, they're not like us Americans, who the average household has three Bibles laying around, right? Like the New Testament hasn't even been put together. It's not been canonized yet. There are no creeds of the church. There is no orthodoxy yet. These people are likely still somewhat new and young believers. And so they're just now learning about God. And now these false teachers are coming in and giving them information. And they're totally confused. They don't know who to trust. They don't know who to look to. But I'd like for us to stop for just a second and think, this 2,000 years later, how much agreement do we have about who God is? I mean, the umbrella of Christianity is pretty broad, isn't it? If you think about all of the different denominations that we have, do you feel like there's any less debate about who God is, who Jesus is, and knowing him? I mean, it seems like we're not in an exact boat, but we're kind of in a real similar boat, aren't we? So that leads us to our next question. Our next question is, so who can we trust? John is writing to help them and to help us have wisdom about who to know, to listen to understand who God is. Let me give you my translation of the passage. So just know this is my translation. I think this is what John is saying. John is saying, if it walks like a duck, it looks like a duck, and it quacks like a duck, it's probably a duck. He's saying that if people follow the ways of Jesus, they love the ways of Jesus, they teach the ways of Jesus, they embody the ways of Jesus, they want to obey Jesus, then those are the people who know God. Listen to them. Trust them. He's saying if they say they have fellowship with God, they should walk in the light. He's saying if they don't do those things, if they're liars and deceivers, they're unloving and unkind to people, if they're sexually immoral, don't listen to those people. Doesn't this sound a whole lot like our sermon like 2 weeks ago? You see, John is circling back with the same themes. He's just using different words. Do you remember back in chapter 1, verse 5, where he said that those who have fellowship, that koinonia, remember what Charlie talked about? Those who have fellowship with God, they walk in the light. He's saying the same thing. He's just using more words to hammer out his message. Do you remember what Charlie told us our takeaway was from that verse 5? He said, if people walk in darkness, meaning that they don't point to Jesus, they're ungodly, they're immoral, they practice all kinds of sexual dysfunction, and they tell you to do the same thing, don't listen to those people. Don't let those people define God for you. Don't let those people be the ones who define God, because Jesus is the one who's always loving, and he's always pointing to the goodness of God. All right, so that brings us to our next point then. If the way that we're going to know who to listen to are those who obey the commands of Jesus and follow his ways, well then, like practically, this is our most practical question, then practically, what does it look like to obey the commands of Jesus? Like, what does John have in mind? In our four verses that we're looking at today, he doesn't exactly spell that out for us. But surely what he has in mind is his gospel account, where he wrote all the things that he could record in a book that Jesus did and taught. Surely he has that in mind. So I'm guessing that now you're thinking I'm going to ask you to, like, let's go through the whole book of John here this morning, right? No, I'm kidding. We're not going to actually try to break our way through the entire book of John this morning. I actually want to go to two different places that are not in John. I actually want to go to things that happen in the Synoptic Gospels. If we're going to know what commands of God to follow, then we might pay attention to a question that was posed to Jesus one time. The question of, what is the greatest command? I mean, that's pretty helpful, isn't it? If we're trying to figure out what commands to follow, Jesus answered the question, which one of the commands is the greatest one? So in Mark chapter 12, beginning in verse 28, let me read that for us. It says, one of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating. Noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, he asked them, of all the commandments, which is the most important? The most important one, answered Jesus, is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. The second is this. Love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. And then in his longest teaching, Jesus' longest teaching, the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus kind of fleshed out for us what it means, what it looks like to love the Lord with all of our heart, soul, mind, strength, and to love our neighbors ourselves. He kind of gave us more words to understand exactly maybe what does that mean. He gave us ideas and told us things in the sermon that says it's good to be meek. It's good to be merciful. It's good to be peacemakers. It's good to bless people when they insult you. Yeah, that's kind of hard, isn't it? He taught we need to be reconciled to people. He said we should honor others and not use them, not even in our minds. He said if somebody steals from you, you should bless them and give them more than they took from you. He said that we should love our enemies and we should pray for the people who are out to get us. Jesus' ways are radical. There's no question about that. Jesus' ways are very radical. And they're sometimes kind of hard, aren't they? But this is what happens to us when we choose to trust him and say, okay, I'm going to try it your way. I'm going to do it the way you're saying it works. This is what happens. Something starts growing inside of us, and it produces joy. Deep, deep, abiding joy. We experience God. We experience his goodness. We feel his nearness and his closeness. And then you know what we're left with? We're left with wanting more. We want more of that joy, more of that goodness. And we discover that the more we obey, then it just happens all over again. We experience his nearness. We experience his pleasure. We experience his closeness. And you know what it does? It makes us want to obey him more. And you know what this cycle of obedience to Jesus does for us? It's in our passage today in verse 5. We read it just a minute ago. It says, "But if anyone obeys his word, love for God is truly made complete in them. This is how we know we are in him. Whoever claims to live in him must live as Jesus did." It doesn't mean that it's going to be perfect. No, it's never going to be perfect. That's not how it's going to work. It's not going to be instantaneous. Paul prayed that we would be rooted and established in God's love. Any of you, like me, plant any trees and shrubs this spring? Guess what they weren't when the heat of summer came? They weren't rooted and established. I had Connie Anderson come out, and I was showing her all these shrubs that I planted, and she said to me, "Yeah, invite me back at the end of August." Connie, if you're in the room, they're all dead. It takes time to grow. Right now is actually the right time to plant things, right? Because it needs time for the roots to grow and be established before the heat comes. No, it's not going to be instantaneous. Growth takes time. So I want to encourage you to do something this week. Can everybody tell me that you'll do something? I know that you have at least 3 Bibles in your home. I want you to read the Sermon on the Mount for yourself. It's found in Matthew chapters 5-7. I want you to read the sermon, and I want you to see for yourself the commands of Jesus. And I want you to ask the Holy Spirit to help you find 1, maybe 2 things. Just go with that. That he can help, that you're convinced that he is inviting you to begin to practice that thing so that your roots can grow deep down into him and that you can be established in him. I want you to pay attention to the commands of Jesus as you're reading it. As you read things like, "Blessed are the meek," I want you to think about, how is Jesus meek? What ways do I see Jesus being meek? What ways might he be inviting me to practice meekness? What areas of my life? You see, as we begin to connect with Jesus and how he is meek and mild and humble of heart, and we start practicing that, what we do is we start apprenticing under Jesus. We start practicing the family business. Do you know it is Jesus' delight to be meek? It is his delight to be meek. And he delights in us when we act like him. We become his children, his dear children. So I want you to read the Sermon on the Mount. I want you to evaluate how Jesus is indeed acting out all of those things that he's commanding us to do. I also want you to pay attention to the end of the sermon. Jesus is addressing exactly what these young churches are experiencing. It's kind of like Jesus knows the future or something. I want you to pay attention to the end of the sermon. He says exactly the scenario that we've just been talking about. He's talking about how false teachers are going to come and they're going to like rip them to shreds. And you know what his advice to them is? Do you think his advice is them to just study so that when you see a lie, you're going to know it? It's not bad advice, right? It's not bad advice. But is that the advice Jesus gave? Not in the Sermon on the Mount. Did he tell them to get on Google, do some real research so that you... He told them to obey him. If we obey him, he knows that that is actually our best good. He is saying that there are people who are coming to confuse us and to deceive us and to rip us to shreds. And the best thing that we can do is to obey him. So that leads us to our last question. How do we know that we know him? When we come to an understanding of that obedience is our best good. We may not always get it right. No, it's not going to be perfect. But our desire changes. Our desire to please Him grows within us. And there's going to always be moments when we think, gosh, I don't have it right. I'm not getting it good enough. Am I doing it well enough? But you know, there's a prayer that really encourages me. It was written by Thomas Merton, and I'd like to read it for us, at least a portion of it. It's not the whole prayer. He says, "I believe that the desire to please you does in fact please you. And I hope I have that desire in all that I'm doing. I hope that I will never do anything apart from that desire. And I know that if I do this, you will lead me by the right road." No, it's not going to look perfect. But if we surrender our wills to His, He'll teach us how to do it. He will complete His love in us. We just have to surrender to Him. So here's what I'd like you guys to do. I'd like you to stand and let's sing with all of our might about surrendering our wills to Him.